Our next episode is titled Psychedelic-Assisted Therapy. When psychedelics comes up in conversation, for some, it's attached to a stigma. For others, it comes with recreational use. And even for some, it comes up in the topic of microdosing. But what does the use of psychedelics look like within the realm of health and wellness, specifically when used to assist with therapy? We're going to explore this and more as we talk with our next guest, Wilhelmina De Castro. Maayong Adlaw, welcome to episode 5 of season 4 for the Philippine X in Wellness podcast. I am your host, Cheryl Sampson Ramirez, and my pronouns are she, her, sha. For this episode's audio description, currently I am wearing a beige top with multiple holes in it. I have hoop earrings, my silver headphones, and I have a background curtain that is white with gray zigzag stripes. Following our last episode, Artistry in Life with Marking, this month we will be talking with psychedelic-assisted therapy. Our guest for this episode is Wilhelmina De Castro, LCSW, founder of Integrate Psychedelic Wellness and Education, interim executive director at Psychedelic Research and Training Institute, PRATI, diversity, equity, and inclusion leader for the Integrative Psychiatry Institute, IPI, and the therapist on COMPASS Pathway Clinical Trial for psilocybin and treatment-resistant depression. As mentioned in previous episodes, all views discussed are for informational and educational purposes only. It's not meant to be medical advice, nor does it constitute therapy or professional advice. Always consult with your healthcare practitioner, especially before starting any exercise or new health program, or a qualified mental health professional for your particular condition. Without further ado, I'd like to welcome to our podcast, Wilhelmina De Castro. Welcome to the podcast, Wilhelmina.
Hi there. I'm happy to be here.
We're happy to have you. Now, Wilhelmina, we typically like to open our episodes with knowing where our guests are from. To your knowledge, where are both sides of your family from, and where are you currently streaming from?
Yeah, so my family is both from Davao and Cebu, and I am streaming from Kumeyaay Land, also known as San Diego, California. And I'm also, for our listeners, I'm also wearing a blue striped shirt, some dark glasses, and a fedora hat. And I'm really, really happy to be here with you all.
Great. We're ready to just dive in. So, and to be honest, Wilhelmina, I'm personally looking forward to learning more from you on this topic, as I've recently heard a few news segments in the past year on psychedelic assisted therapy in relation to veterans living with PTSD on the news. Let's start off with defining for our community, what is psychedelic-assisted therapy?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that psychedelics have existed for a very long time and have different lineages of healing. But what we see in this psychedelic resurgence is this component of psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy or therapy. And it's really this union of psychedelic medicines or drugs and therapy administered in a controlled and safe setting, particularly to address a lot of different mental health challenges or symptoms that folks are experiencing.
Okay, now that we have a clearer picture of what psychedelic assisted therapy consists of, tell us about when and how this originated within the mental health field. I know you're also an LCSW like myself, mm-hmm. and the events that led you to practice this particular modality?
Yeah, I mean, I think some history that's maybe even just worth looking up for some of the listeners is just to understand, there's been like a little bit of some dark history of also psychedelics, and it's existed in many lineages. But in the United States, there was this like, especially in the time of the 60s, there were a lot of psychedelics being used. And because of different government controls or also misuse, and psychedelics were disallowed. And so if you look at some of the studies under Timothy Leary, also Ram Dass, and really looking at the examination of how to leverage LSD for particular mental health symptoms, there is a history that in the United States around these particular components that have since been criminalized. And so what we're finding now is this resurgence of some of the research and interest, particularly in some of the medicines like psilocybin, which in the context of the United States have primarily come from the lineages of the Mazatec people through Maria Sabina. And we are now bringing into our awareness its impact and its actually benefit, particularly for diagnosis, these what they often call these orphan diagnoses of PTSD, in which we don't have a solution and we don't have the right medicine for to treat this diagnosis.
You mentioned, was it the Mazatec people? Mm-hmm. How do you spell that?
Mazatec.
And where are they based out of?
They're out of Oaxaca, Mexico.
Okay, so a lot of the usage of it was within Mexico, or is it the research that we're finding where they've been using it?
They've been using that there for decades and centuries as part of it's a part of their life. Medicines and it's also a way of life in which the container in which they hold the medicine. And so this is something that is worth like critically examining too, in like this psychedelic resurgence, to make sure that we are keeping to the spirit and the lineage of the medicine and not necessarily filtering it completely through a Western context. And so this is hard. This is a line that I kind of walk to, of being a trained licensed clinical social worker in getting a license in the state of California, and connecting with the history and the lineage of these medicines that are also so powerful. So this is something that's like always up for discussion of, are we in right relationship with the medicines that we are providing and that we're sharing?
I see. Are you talking about like within the mental health world in terms of right relationship, or just in general?
I think all around, I think we're an extractive and a consumptive culture too. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes when we find something that works or that is beneficial, I mean, even if we see the history of tobacco too, how the Western society has really, filtered it through their lens, and even it's turned into an addictive substance. And we've moved away from its sacredness and its sacred use in communities. So I think we have to be really careful around things, especially like plant medicines like psilocybin, that we are not moving towards that same direction.
Right. Now, many licensed clinical social workers, LMFTs, different therapists within the professional mental health setting typically choose modalities to specialize in from brain spotting, cognitive behavioral therapy. How did you particularly find yourself on the road, or what led you to dive in deeply more into psychedelic assisted therapy as your chosen modality?
Yeah, I think my personal path is being in community social work for a long time. I think there were organizations and communities I was part of in which social work felt important. It felt integrated in community. And there were other places I worked in which social work felt like an arm of the law enforcement system or arm of the criminal justice system, which I didn't, that didn't resonate for me in many ways. So, you know, when I look at different modalities of therapy, I think all of those modalities I still use, like, you know, CBT and internal family systems, or those are the one, particularly internal family systems are really helpful in complementing the work with psychedelics. And so I actually like to look at psychedelics as a different way of experiencing integrative health and integrative psychiatry.
And then how did you find particularly institutions that were teaching this modality? I know it's not always readily available to everyone. I actually, when I was getting my LCSW, I never knew that this modality existed. So how did you get exposure to this?
Yeah, I mean, I think conversations like this, like word of mouth, and there was often this like subculture of like social workers and community mental health therapists where we were so committed to the work, but there was a lot that we felt was unfair, systemically being underpaid, not being able to move in the direction or even get results with our community that we knew inherently they were capable of. And so a lot of this was like examining community mental health psychiatry and saying, like, is there more? Are we just doing symptom reduction and symptom management? Is there a way that we can support community to be in their fully embodied self? And so I think through these conversations with some colleagues even, I found out that one person was getting trained in psychedelic assisted work, and there were scholarships available for the training. And so I went for it, and something clicked for me in that training as a way to really support my community in a different generative way.
So if someone were to want to pursue a similar training path, what schools would you recommend for them in being able to?
Yeah, I think some of the more formal institutions are just getting there in terms of like, there's not necessarily, I think there's maybe one arriving in terms of like a master's of like psychedelic work. But there's certifications. And so currently I'm the executive director of the Psychedelic Research and Training Institute, which is also where I got trained, particularly in ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. Okay. And so that is a training that's like different than any other, which includes an experiential with the medicine.
Okay.
And so to me, that was one of the most fascinating parts of, instead of just cognitively and intellectually or academically learning about the molecule and the medicines, I got to experience it in my body.
I see. You mentioned earlier about the impact of using psychedelic assisted therapy for treating things like PTSD. What have you seen in regards to your experience on how this has been helping individuals living with PTSD?
Yeah, there's two particular medicines that are in clinical trials right now, which are psilocybin and MDMA, which we're starting to see significant benefits for PTSD. And so those are the two. And MDMA is very, very close to FDA approval, in which we hope could be accessible for many who are suffering through this illness.
I see. And how are they able to, how is medicine able to help them through from what you're seeing in the clinical trials?
Well, I think it's worth like studying some of the molecules of like and the different receptors that both MDMA and psilocybin. And I think as an example, and I wouldn't necessarily know all of the neurobiology around it, so I definitely recommend researching it.
Sure.
Some of the key benefits of something like MDMA is that we often have this like default mode network that is constantly repeating. And in this default mode is when we have, it's the self-referential part of our being. So the way that we perceive ourselves, and how we perceive the world sees us. And so in this default mode with many of these medicines, they can support you in pausing that default mode or those like repetitive loops, whether they're like repetitive trauma loops or repetitive narratives. And it helps us to take a break from those loops. And it also supports neurogenesis, which is the activation and the growth of the neural connections. And so when we have a really traumatized or really depressed brain, you can see that there is serious impact in these neurons firing. So with something like MDMA, it kind of quiets the noise, I think, to simplify it. It creates new neural connections. And because of the also some of the receptors and the qualities of this medicine, if there is a strong therapeutic relationship, it also creates a safe bond to be able to be with particularly difficult memories or moments or activations and work in and through them in a way that folks can reconstitute themselves in their trauma instead of fighting it, fleeing it, or avoiding it. So I think that's like an almost high level overview. There's much more complicated parts of this work, but yeah, it's really leveraging the therapeutic relationship as well as these key aspects of transformation within the molecule.
I see.
Now, most people, when they think of MDMA, when they think of psilocybin or sometimes ketamine, it's associated with microdosing, right? Or partying, right? Mm-hmm. Like MDMA, like, you know, the street name for it is ecstasy, right? And psilocybin, street name, like most people know it as mushrooms. How would you differentiate people like partying or microdosing on this medicine versus using it in a therapeutic setting?
Yeah, I think there is definitely two different, we talk about like set and setting. And mm-hmm. So when folks are using it in a recreational sense, I also think there's benefits to that. There's communities made and important experiences that are had in recreational settings too. And I think the harder part is that those settings aren't controlled settings. And so along with the benefits of connection and bonding, there's also the potential for risk and harm in some of those settings where we're not able to necessarily control the dose at times. And so when we do it in the therapeutic setting, there's different intentions and the container of the experience is also different. So I think it's important to know that like when folks come in to be able to engage in this process, they should know that it's a different experience than using it recreationally.
Right. Okay. Now let's talk more about your training so we can be able to differentiate this for folks. Mm-hmm. Your training, for example, consists of ketamine assisted psychotherapy, also known as CAP, through PRATI. Mm-hmm. And MDMA-assisted psychotherapy through the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, also known as MAPS. Provide us with an overview of these treatment modalities between ketamine and MDMA and the medicine.
Yeah. I could probably speak to ketamine-assisted psychotherapy more because it is something that we're using presently.
Cool.
And the protocol for MDMA, I think a person has to go to the training to fully understand what that training protocol is.
Okay.
Sure. So ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, I think, is a very good first medicine to use therapeutically for multiple reasons. Generally, ketamine is pretty safe. And it's a shorter medicine. So when you look at like MDMA or psilocybin, you're looking at like journeys from like maybe 4 to 6 or 8 hours. Ketamine journeys are maybe 2 if 3 hours. The different training around this that I think contextually is different is that it brought me back to understanding how my presence and also my skill can significantly impact the psychedelic journey of my client. And so that includes like the relationship I have with my client, that includes how we prep them, how do we assess somebody's ready for the work, how do I consult with a prescriber or a physician to collaborate on like what dose and frequency would be the most helpful for what the client is presenting. And then there's also in ketamine, there's different routes of administration that have different indications for each person. So in this training through Prati, particularly, you know, we learn some of the art and science of dosing and psychedelic work, but we also get to embody and feel what it's like to create a safe container for this non-ordinary state of consciousness.
Okay. And then, so you mentioned the assessment, the intake process.
Mm-hmm.
What is the therapeutic experience like? Also, you having experienced it through your training, how would you describe it for someone that's curious about what they might go through? You can even talk about maybe like number of sessions, like what they'll, I know each individual is different, but maybe kind of what they might move through in this work.
Yeah. So for someone just like coming in that's curious or feeling like, an example is ketamine is particularly helpful for treatment-resistant depression, which means someone has gone through like a series of modalities and even medications and attempts to mitigate and address their depression, and they haven't succeeded in that. And so for many times folks come to me with like, I tried everything. I tried an SSRI. I've tried this type of therapy, and there's still something there that I can't move. Or that I'm feeling really, really stuck in. And so when we assess that they qualify for the treatment, and that's done through an intensive psychosocial screening, it's also done through like a psychiatric screening, then we work on prepping. And so that's prepping for what might emerge, some history, also understanding intergenerational and lineages of like, just kind of even legacy burdens and going through like a cultural genogram so that we understand, we never know what might come up, but we can always try to explore how we can be ready should something come up. And so when I say that, it's like, you know, when we're asking around like histories of trauma mm-hmm. or challenging experiences and really being asking the client of like, if this comes up, you know, what does support look like? How would you like me to help you through this difficult moment? And we also talk about, what if you feel bliss? What if you feel joy? You know, that is also healing work, because oftentimes they're attached to like, I got to work through my healing. It has to be hard for it to work. That's not actually true. Some people return to remembering to play, remembering to move their body, finding joy again. And so those are all components that we explore in the prep. And then through different types of like, I think, therapeutic strategies and parts work through internal family systems, which is my preference, then we collaborate on when we're ready to actually go into a dosing session with a medicine. And when both I feel okay with it and my prescriber and the client feels okay, then we schedule in the session. And ideally, we would have 4 to 6 medicine sessions for treatment-resistant depression. And every case is different. And so sometimes we'll do 2 sessions, or sometimes we'll do 1. And then between each session, there's also integration. So we'll begin to like understand when someone's not in there, in their medicine state, how they are weaving in the insights and the learnings.
Okay. And you said that typically maybe a session might take from 2 to 3 hours, or?
Yeah, my sessions are usually about 2 hours. Okay. It depends on the route of administration that we use.
And how do you determine, like, hey, maybe this individual might benefit from maybe one session to like three sessions? How do you make that determination?
Sometimes we determine it like after the first session because we don't know. The first session is, we tend to say it's like you're meeting the medicine and building the relationship with it. And oftentimes my clients are like, oh, I could never, it's very ineffable in terms of it's hard to explain. So like now that I know what it's like in there, I'm ready to go back in, or maybe perhaps I can go a little bit higher in my dose because I have now built this like infrastructure of familiarity and comfort. So usually after this first session is when we'll decide, I think, in a more informed way, how many more we'll do.
Are there any, I know sometimes people might all be always like intimidated by maybe like side effects, long-term effects, withdrawals. Does that ever occur when interacting with the medicine?
So ketamine, I think I'll speak to ketamine because that's my most familiar medicine,
Sure.
is so something to think about is that when you're working with medicines, you're doing a lot of big work. Some folks say it's like you're doing like 10 therapy sessions in 2 hours. So for people to be tired, it's pretty common. One of the most common side effects is some level of nausea, but for some, we pre-medicate with that. So the prescriber will medicate and provide some like anti-nausea medicine and give that to them afterwards. And some people feel energized and feel fine after. So it really just depends on the person's constitution of their body. So that's probably the major side effects that I have seen so far in the practice. Now, when we get a little bit higher in age, or if there's some like comorbidity and other kind of medical components that are happening, then we'll talk with the doctor to see like what kind of supports we need to help this person move through their medicine experience.
And is this something that someone would be able to like return to work, you know, the next day, or would they need to take time off of work when they're actually going through these experiences and these ceremonies?
Yeah, I think there's like an ideal, right, of giving yourself just time before all the other stimulation comes in. Of like, I often do a lot of my sessions on Fridays, so if people work a traditional work week, they don't have to jump right back in to work, and so if they can have time to just decompress and be, that would be ideal. And then also that's not the reality for some folks. So we also take that into consideration and make sure everyone is fully informed of, how they might feel. But you
Got it.
definitely can't work after you take
Right.
medicine.
Right. And is there any particular preparation also prior to?
Yeah, there's the therapeutic and even spiritual preparation of just noticing if there's like resistance or there's worry or normal anxiousness. And so we'll work through that preparation and developing intentions around it and even protections depending on like the spiritual or emotional practice of people, then we invite in however they would like to use that in the ceremony as well. And then in terms of like physical prep, there is fasting about like 3 or so hours before. We ask folks to kind of stay pretty gentle with themselves the evening and abstain from weed and alcohol, mostly because it does dull the effects of the ketamine.
You also talked about integration in between sessions. What does that entail?
Yeah, so a lot of the time when folks are actually in medicine session, my role, depending on the dose, so when you look at psychedelic assisted therapy, there's different ways of like there is like a very like low dose, which is like empathic dose, and it's kind of like heart opening. in which you can engage and talk and just be a little bit more open. And then we have what we would call like a psycholytic dose, in which you are still have your capacity to talk and be and engage with the material, but it's with some of those defenses down, where you can do a little more self-examination. And then we have the psychedelic dose, in which the person is really internal in their journey. And my job is to facilitate a safe space and make sure that their journey is not interrupted, and making sure that they're comfortable. And so depending on the dose that we're working with and the needs of the client, you know, that will all depend on the way I'm speaking or not speaking with words during a session. And the integration session after, you know, there's so much malleability and plasticity in the brain after a medicine session. And some of that will like contract and some of that will stay. And so sometimes we'll have very similar therapy sessions, but let's say we'll examine the different insights or the different ways they are relating to the same material now that they have this increased brain plasticity. Mm. And also some of the protective parts are a little bit more dissolved.
Mm. And how do you determine, because like in a traditional therapeutic like model, right, maybe you might have like a certain number of sessions with a client and then you're ready to get to prepare for like a discharge or, you know, an end to the therapeutic relationship. Yeah. How do you determine within psychedelic assisted therapy when someone is ready to, well, when you're ready to, I guess, yeah, and the therapeutic relationship with them?
Yeah, I mean, I think we talk about it at the very beginning. A lot of folks come to me with, they maybe already have a therapist. Uh-huh. And their therapist may not be familiar with psychedelic assisted work. So they will come to me for the psychedelic assisted work, and I will collaborate with their therapist that they already have. So sometimes it's like a warm handoff. Mm-hmm. Back into their community or their therapist. And it really just depends. Sometimes we continue the therapeutic relationship because the integration is needing more time. It's just, mm-hmm. you know, needing more time. It's needing more spaciousness. Other times folks are feeling complete that they would like to just try on their own. And, but we always are talking about the way that they have close communal support, people that they can talk to about their experience so that they are not isolated in what they've experienced.
Okay. Now, we mainly talked about ketamine. I wanted to ask you, Wilhelmina, are there other psychedelics that are being used for therapeutic use that you'd like to explore in the future that you haven't been officially trained on yet that's out there and being explored within the realm of mental health?
Yeah, there's a lot of clinical trials and also decriminalization too of medicines like psilocybin and MDMA and LSD. So I think over time, I'm not necessarily like this proponent for ketamine only. It is the thing that is legally here and that's available now. There's a lot of bureaucracy around like legalization and decriminalization. And I also want to acknowledge that there are just like a lot of amazing underground workers too that work with many of these medicines and are very skilled and gifted in the way they work. But because of the intersection of like just my social location and my work, I choose to work in this way with ketamine.
Okay. Yeah, I know some people also to participate in like peyote or ayahuasca ceremonies for similar reasons. So, yeah, those are just some of the things that I wanted to mention also that we're not talking about here.
Yeah, I think there's a wide array of medicines and even some that we have yet to discover in terms of their therapeutic use for for mental and spiritual health. And I think a lot of this is, like, interestingly enough, when we have this molecule like ketamine, and when I first came into ketamine, I wasn't, like, super enthused about it. It was like, you want to practice psychedelic therapy? This is the one medicine you can use now. And so I kind of was hating on it. I wasn't sure. And then I had my own experience and my own training. And I've since then been able to see the profound effects it has on my clients. And so it made me like a believer of sorts. But with that being said, there are so many other plant and medicine allies out there that are, you know, that we're able to use for healing.
And there's also the other end of the spectrum, right? That people are exploring plant medicine, maybe in settings where they're not like always under proper guidance, or there's also cultural appropriation that occurs when it comes to exploring medicine that is indigenous to certain cultures, certain peoples, certain nations, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of folks talk about like the psychedelic renaissance as another way of looking at like psychedelic colonization too. And I think that's definitely worth examining, and that I continue to examine in my own process of like, am I in right relationship with this work and this medicine? And sometimes I have to pause because the answer becomes unclear at certain junctures in my journey too. I think there's, because we're such an extractive and stealing, I mean, the Western culture is so extractive in that oftentimes they will use, whether it's symbols or practices in which they have don't have the permission to use, and use them for like their like financial benefit too.
Yeah.
So I think this, like, that level of appropriation, it's already here. It's been here. And so, which is why it's important to talk about, like, continuing to talk about the decolonization of psychedelic medicine in order to bring light to what's happening, and to also not repeat all the tragedies that we've repeated in our history.
Yeah, no, agreed fully. Let's talk more about the legalization of psychedelic medicine. So is psychedelic-assisted therapy right now, is it recognized nationally, or is it only legal in certain states?
So if we think about, like, just the medicines, like, ketamine is legal.
Okay.
There's different, like, ketamine clinics in which there's, like, no therapy, right? Some people get ketamine for chronic pain. Some people are receiving ketamine for depression, but with no support. So the psychedelic-assisted therapy, you know, I think under the auspices of the different, like, bureaus and authorities, and we're still engaging in therapy, right?
Right.
And we look at it as, like, also integrated medicine of, like, our clients come in and they're on prescription medicine. They may be on, like, Zoloft, and they take their Zoloft every morning, and they come in and we, you know, we see their medicine is working, and then we have a conversation, and then there's, like, some gains, and there's some process around that. So if you look at the historical frameworks of, like, CBT or ACT, they had been paired with different types of medicines for a very long time and had been seen as useful. So I will say these medicines, like ketamine, MDMA, psilocybin, are other medicines that we have not been given access to for our healing. I think that has something to say also about, like, pharma companies of, like, I think a lot of these medicines can actually get us better and get us off of them too. And so I think that's why these medicines are often dangerous to big pharma and big companies, because we actually don't, we may not build a dependence on them. We actually might get better and not need to use them.
Yeah, no, right. That's especially what are the challenges that exist in a capitalist country, right, that thrives off of profit and off of people being sick, right? And so when there's competition with that, then that's deemed as a threat, and that also influences policy and legalization in many ways. Do you know if ketamine or any other psychedelics are legal in other countries, to your knowledge?
You know, I think,
and I should clarify, in the use of the therapeutic settings.
I'm not too familiar. You know, I think there's I think it's newer in some places. But I'm not really familiar on a global context of how it's being used.
Okay. And how did ketamine make its way into being like recognized as an effective therapeutic model?
You know, I'm trying to think of if I remember the lineage of it, but I know that in the discovery of ketamine, when used at a sub-anesthetic dose, they noticed in patients that there would be a significant change in mood. And so when you think about like the actual amount of ketamine that is being used in the session, it's pretty minimal and fractional to like what you would use in the emergency room. And so when you're at that sub-anesthetic dose is where we can really work on some of those therapeutic benefits and therapeutic goals. But I can't remember totally the history of how it was discovered and brought in.
No worries. Okay. So aside from psychedelics being recognized as an effective therapeutic modality, what are some of the challenges that you feel get in the way of legalizing other psychedelics within the therapeutic realm?
I think when we're having like mind-altering substances, we always have to examine who is facilitating, what is the container and the physical space look like, and the potentiality for abuse, right? Not just abuse of the medicine, but the abuses between facilitators and journeyers too. I think, you know, I don't want to bypass that there's been also a lot of harms in the psychedelic space as well. And so I think that's one of the biggest challenges of like, if we make this legal and accessible, who will be facilitating? Who will be, you know, how will that be monitored? But I think the whole hope of like the decriminalization and legalization of medicines is that we can create more access for those that need it. And then we can teach on how to create a safe container, and so that people aren't necessarily doing these journeys with unsafe people. That being said, like there's very safe and powerful underground facilitation happening as well. And oftentimes when we come with like regulating parties and legalization, it gets really expensive to conduct a therapeutic session because of all of the licensing, the actual regulations of the physical space. And so I think we're kind of caught in a little bit of a conundrum of how do we continue to make this work accessible, safe, and legal while, you know, while not diluting the medicine experience. And oftentimes, like, I think one of the biggest worries too, which is when we make this legal, does this create a ripple effect of the over-harvesting of medicines too? And so, you know, there is synthetic psilocybin that is used in like the clinical trials in which the psilocin, and actually psilocybin, is what we are looking at in terms of like the agent of change within the medicine. So I think those are some of the things that I see emerging in the different structures of, you know, whether it's Oregon or Colorado, of how to roll out this these medicines in a way that we still create accessibility.
And with the commercialization of plant medicine, how does a potential client, a future client, how can they be more discerning to determine whether they're going to enter a safe therapeutic space versus, as you mentioned when you opened this episode, how there's also been a history of dark spaces in usage? How can someone be able to discern what would be the more appropriate and professional use of the plant medicine?
Yeah, I think there's what I often share with other facilitators and myself is like, I invite clients to ask these questions of like, we're not looking for perfect spaces, but we are looking for brave enough and safe enough spaces of like, if a rupture does happen, if a client like reaches out their hand for support and, you know, I didn't grab it in time and they're feeling like some level of abandonment or things like that, there likely can be these micro and even bigger ruptures in this space. And so in the beginning, we talk about it of like, hey, there could be some stuff that comes up where like, I didn't care for you in the way you wanted to be or hoping to be cared for, or that, you know, whatever part of the journey was difficult. And what would that look like, you know, to work through that process together? You know, can we come up with an agreement around that? And if there's a rupture that would happen, like, how do we reestablish? What would be helpful to reestablish our relationship and safety again? And so those are some things that are talked about in the very beginning around informed consent too, of like, what could happen? What will likely happen in this session? And asking all of the questions of like, you know, who are your teachers? Who do you consult with? Who holds you accountable in community? Where did you get your training from? Has there been any issues of sexual abuse or violence in between you and your client? Or do you have, you know, I think that those are things that I would hope to impart to my clients and other journeyers to ask to make sure that they are stepping into a safe place.
And thank you for that. I mean, because I know that we're a global podcast, and so there are people that are listening or viewing in from other parts of the world. Well, Mina, you're based in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
So if there are other people like in other regions, do you know other places or locations where they might be able to pursue a similar modality, psychedelic assisted therapy? Like, what are those other regions that you're aware of where they are practicing this professionally?
Yeah, I think they can legally access psilocybin assisted therapy over in the Netherlands. Canada's doing a lot of like amazing work too. Some folks may be able to enter into a clinical trial here, especially if they want to work with psilocybin and MDMA. And I'm not sure about, I mean, there's obviously like long lineages and histories of accessing medicine in the global South too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think making sure you have a trusted person that is referring you there and that you do your own research in all of these different places. So it depends on what they're looking for. If they're looking for like assisted therapy, that is definitely much more steeped in somewhat of a Western model. But if they're looking for like ceremonial and a shamanic container, that's also going to be different too. So it's different, the matrix of different things that people need, and they may experience all of them at different parts of their life.
Is there actually like a directory out there for them to like kind of like a Psychology Today within this realm, or?
Yeah, there's a website called Psychedelic Support.
Okay.
And that's where a lot of my clients find me. And okay. Folks can Google that and the research, like, you know, psychedelic therapists in your area.
So, Now, let's get more familiar with how this, with the use of psychedelic-assisted therapy, and maybe some of the skepticism or, I guess, I would say dismissal of this. So on your Integrate Evolve website, you refer to the substances as medicine rather than drugs. And you mentioned that throughout this podcast as well. I've heard reluctance and skepticism within our community, you know, whether it's mental health or even within the Philippine or Philippine X community towards psychedelic assisted therapy due to maybe their experiences of substance use and addiction or its impact within like the multiple intersectionalities that we exist in. Why do you in particular refer to psychedelics as medicine, and how do you prevent your clients from addiction either during or post-session?
Yeah, I think the semantics of this, they carry weight. Like language creates particular realities. And I think what we're up against is this history of like the war against drugs and like the demonization of like communities of color. And so I think just like acknowledging the historic use of the word drugs and the communities that it is tied to. And so I vacillate kind of between these two to be able to almost kind of sometimes disrupt what our assumptions might be when we use these certain words too. And some people might be activated by the word medicine as well. But for me, when I think in this stage of like, I'm kind of agnostic to what those words mean to me as I use them as like pathways into kind of pathways into really cultivating that inner healing intelligence. And so there, I think that's like worth examining for our like the community of listeners of like, what comes up in my body when I hear the word drugs versus what comes up in my body when I hear the word medicine. And so ketamine can be a drug in one place. Ketamine can be a medicine in another place too. So for me, that disruption of our assumption of consciousness can be really helpful and create some like malleability in curiosity too. But I think when you speak about like addiction, I think there's something to that we have to be careful around too, because when all of these different substances, drugs or medicines are engaged in without clear intention and knowledge and information and guidance and safety, there is a possibility for harm and there is a possibility for addiction. And and there's some medicines that have, and just like in pharmaceutical medicines that have a higher vulnerability for addiction, and some that don't.
Right.
And so, you know, I've worked with folks with a history of addiction and still, you know, and still want to work with medicine. And that is something that we work through significantly in prep of when do we sense in that the addictive mind is entering into the conversation. When do we pause? How do we gain support for that? And sometimes we work really in kind of a wraparound. Do we, you know, do we work with your support system on how we can notice if we're reaching into kind of some murky waters around addiction? So that's nothing that like, we're not pretending that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Because it can. And we have to, it's our duty to kind of stay conscious and be informed around it.
And I also imagine there's some psychoeducation that takes place around the use of ketamine or MDMA. Right.
Yeah. I think there's, you know, oftentimes I talk to my clients around just like, hey, there's been historic atrocities around psychedelics, around even with community folks like Elijah McClain, where they used too much ketamine to sedate them, you know, prior to them passing. And so there are the shadowy and dark sides of how this medicine is being leveraged. And so it's important that we talk about that, because that shows up in the resistance and the fear. And then we talk about how it's going to be used for their particular process.
Yeah. Just to provide a more balanced view and a more honest view when it comes to using the medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're Pilipinx in Wellness, Wilhelmina. Let's talk about the context of psychedelic-assisted therapy within our community. What do you think in particular the Filipino Pilipinx community, how would they benefit from psychedelic-assisted therapy? What kinds of areas do you think psychedelic-assisted therapy would help address when it comes to our community?
In attempts to not make generalizations about the community, as a Filipinx person, I can speak about how it's leveraged in my own healing we are burdened with this myth of the model minority too, as like Southeast Asians and Asians, and that carries like a long lineage of like needing to succeed, needing to make sure that my parents' strife and migration to the United States becomes worth it, you know, this like attempt to be like successful, and many even oftentimes ignoring my own desires or my own drives or passions. And so, and this is not by any means the fault of like my parents, but it's a fault of circumstance too. When we're placed in, or power is impressed upon us to have to make decisions to survive. And so, and it's similar across many cultures and people of the global majority. And so some of the things that feel alive for me when I talk about psychedelics are like the pressure to be the good enough child, the pressure to not bring shame to my family, the need to kind of climb the academic ladder, and be the highest performer, and also to prove myself. You know, some of these things that if truly like internalized over and over, it brings me farther and farther away from my truest self. Mm-hmm. And so in this work of psychedelics, I've been able to kind of like soften what those assumptions are for me. Like, even this desire, the assumption that I'm going to be like this, like cis, like straight kind of person and just climbing the academic and professional ladder. It's actually helped me to love and be more compassionate towards like my queerness, towards my gender expansiveness. Mm-hmm. And the more I learn about how pre-colonially there's like so much gender queerness and queerness in our like lineage, like pre-Spanish, pre-colonization, pre-imperialism, then it actually helps me to connect that I am truly rooted in my ancestry. And sure. It's one thing to think about that, like in critical analysis, and it's a different thing to feel that in your body. And so the wisdom that emerges from my spirit and my body when I work with medicines helps me to feel like a more integrated person, that I'm not just conceptualizing or analyzing my decolonization, I'm embodying it. So I think for me, that is a gift of this work. And it's delicate, and we have to be very careful with the work, but that's something that it's been offered to me, especially over these last few years.
Yeah, that's very noteworthy, what you just mentioned, because we touched on that in our Pilipinx episode that we had with Dr. Pal and Gia Sotero in a couple earlier episodes, and how the role of gender expansive, gender fluid, trans folks in our community was in a shamanic role. And so it's fascinating to now see this alignment that you're having in our more, later state, right? I don't want to say contemporary or modern, because that can be like really like words that can just be kind of cliche or thrown around, but how it's like you're aligning, like you mentioned, with your ancestral lineage and roots, and how we're generations later in a different evolution of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, I just visited the Philippines a few weeks ago. I think I was sharing with you, and even the way that I'm in relationship and step onto the land and swim in the water feels different. There's a different access point that I'm able to engage in, that quiets some of the noise of like the Western capitalist colonialist views. And so I'm thankful to have more access to that.
Yeah. And sometimes like research or academia, they sometimes, you know, taking a critical statement, but they fall short of being able to fully understand what that's like to integrate yourself into that within your body and within your spirituality. Mm-hmm. You know, and these are some things that are just unexplainable, but like feel like full alignment. And I'm just glad that you were able to speak to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really special. And it's also making me more curious to learn around the other profound healing modalities of our people, you know, of like that I felt so distant from. And I'm still like, I'm in a process of remembering, and I'm trying to, you know, and sometimes this work can really help in this magic and this process of remembering our deepest histories.
For sure. There's so many plants like within the Philippines, right? Or within the islands, the archipelago that we're from, that mm-hmm. were used for medicinal purposes. Mm-hmm. Some that might have been eradicated from our colonizers, others that, as you mentioned, also have gone underground to preserve. And we have yet to explore and discover that those usages within our community and our culture.
Yeah.
Let's talk about now, like, so if someone would be interested, right, in signing up for psychedelic assisted therapy, how would they sign up with you, Wilhelmina, and tell us more about what that process would entail?
Yeah, so I think folks could sign up like just via my website or reaching out even through Instagram. And one of the first steps is like having the right facilitator is really important in this work. And I'm not everyone's cup of tea, and everyone's not my cup of tea. And so, and even I think more than that, it's like, is the relationship right there so that we can reach optimal healing for this person? And that depends on like my expertise, what's going on with them, what kind of relationship they are seeking. And so we have a discovery call, and we kind of learn, and some of that can't be discovered right in the first call, but we say like, okay, I actually think there's more here. And then we continue to dive deeper. And so if someone is feeling like it's a good fit for myself and them, mm-hmm. then we will just begin kind of building the relationship and building our attunement to one another, learning. And then through that, I generally trust like when it's right, the timing. Then we'll go into screening, which is like screening if they are the right fit for the medicine. So I will do the psychosocial screening. I'll work with some of our doctors and prescribers around the medical screening for the medicine. And after that, we decide the route and the way, and even co-creating and crafting the ceremony together. Then we continue with prep, and then we schedule the medicine dosing day. And so with that, I operate, and this is not every psychedelic assisted therapist, I operate ceremonially because that helps me as a facilitator. And so I have some things that I work through, like internally, to prep me to be with someone in a non-ordinary state of consciousness. And then I welcome them in to, you know, create an altar that they want, to create, to bring grounding items, whatever they would like. So I invite them in to bring whatever they need into the space to feel grounded, to feel safe. And we set up a safety plan, who's going to pick them up, who are their support systems, and I have those people ready. We also talk about like all the different circumstances that can happen and how we navigate them, mm-hmm. and what support would look like, and what would supportive touch look like or no touch. And even like consenting to the different smells in the room, whether there's like candles or incense or spray, all of those things that can like viscerally impact and even spiritually or energetically impact someone. And then we usually work on like some sort of like somatic grounding, meditation, even use sounds. And then we begin the journey. And so if we're working with the oral lozenges of ketamine, they'll work and ingest the ketamine. And so it works in which they are like swishing it around in their mouth, and it enters through, you know, their mouth lining and slowly. And so that's about like 12 to 15 minutes. And then what we also call the hidden therapist in the room is that there's a particular playlist that we play with medicine work. And with ketamine in particular, the likelihood for synesthesia or the blurring of the senses is really high. And so people may see colors. You know, when they hear music, they will see it. They'll see the music, or they'll sense nature around them somehow. And so there's a playlist that creates like an arc for them to follow in the journey. And so they're usually in eye shades and headphones, and then they're fully immersed. And then they journey for about 90 minutes. And then when sometimes they're ready to kind of come out, so they'll take things off, or they have to go to the bathroom. So they'll come out of the journey. And sometimes I'll meet them with like some live sounds, with like some sound healing instruments. And then just gently bring them back into this plane of consciousness. And if it feels ready, we will have some conversation. But generally, when we go into deeper journeys, I try to avoid over-processing, because it usually brings folks back into their default mode.
Mm-hmm.
So we just allow them to be and let all of the different insights or whatever experience has settle in. And we kind of check on them, see how they're feeling, any nausea, little safety checks. And then when the medicine is worn off enough, when we close out the ceremony, and then eventually, you know, sometimes we'll have some snacks or some tea, and then they'll be on their way. And then I'll usually check in with folks later that evening or the next day. And then a few days later or the next day, we'll have an integration session. And so, which will look much more like kind of like a traditional therapy session.
Okay, so you're not talking to them throughout the journey like traditional talk therapy. You're actually there facilitating and letting whatever occurs come up as an observer, or?
Yeah, it depends. And I think this is where it feels different than traditional therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Although it happens in therapy, is like this use of silence and this use of ourselves and our bodies, of like being the grounded presence in the room, and also being ready if somebody has something that they want to talk about, right? I mean, sometimes I think they might be quiet or pretty internal, and then they want to verbally process. Or oftentimes I also act as a scribe. So people will talk through their journey and have these different insights. They're not necessarily talking to me, but they're talking out loud. And so I'll write things down, and then we'll use that material to work with post-session.
Wow. Okay. No, thank you for describing the process. It just makes things clearer for myself and even our community.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned ketamine being also helpful for folks with PTSD, depression, chronic pain. Are there other parts, like other conditions that ketamine or psychedelics can help to help someone heal through other maybe conditions or areas that you'd like to mention?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of research coming out around like ketamine for OCD and other medicines as well as for OCD. Also for existential distress and end of life. And I think these medicines, ketamine and then psilocybin in particular, can be really helpful for those that may have experienced existential distress due to, like, you know, a terminal illness or diagnosis, or experiencing grief and loss of any sorts. But those are, like, I think some components in which we're seeing there's significant research around. There's also been some work around ketamine for alcoholism and addiction too.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of different clinical trials and research coming out that we, you know, can stay up to date on.
What about the age range of your clients? What have been your youngest and your eldest client?
Yeah, I had my youngest, probably a 17-year-old with some serious depression. And he consented along with his family to the work. I think one of our oldest clients were in their 70s, mid-70s. So I think ketamine in particular is really safe. And you know, I think something to note when we are working with, like, the higher doses of ketamine and the intramuscular route of administration, we also have nurses in the room, too.
Oh, okay.
And so I talked about, like, the oral dose, which you don't necessarily need a nurse or a medical professional in the room. But when we're working with administration of intramuscular ketamine, mm-hmm. we have our nurses or doctors that are there administering and also monitoring too.
Oh, nice. That probably helps people, like, feel safer when they hear that. Yeah.
So I think some people with some, like, medical anxiety or some worry, that tends to be the helpful route to know that they're being monitored and cared for from someone that has a medical scope of practice.
Cool. And you talked about earlier it being expensive. What is the cost of, like, your sessions or the journeys? Like, what are we looking at for people that are curious about how much it would cost for the services?
Yeah, so for my sessions that are about maybe 2 to 3 hours, depending, it'll be $500 per session.
Uh-huh.
And so I think it's important to kind of put this in context of, like, you know, many folks who are working on treatment-resistant depression, they're in, like, many psychiatric appointments, paying for medication, a lot of therapy for over a span of, like, 5, 10, 15 years, right?
Yeah.
And so, although we can't promise anything, when we have a solution that is, like, shown pretty amazing results for treatment-resistant depression, mm-hmm. and you're doing it in a series of, like, 4 to 6, you know, limited series of ketamine, and maybe some, like, booster sessions eventually, economically, there's a different benefit, you know, mm-hmm. of, like, how folks are investing into the work. And so, 500, I also work in sliding scale. Like, I also work in a group model too, which makes it much more financially accessible too.
Okay.
When folks journey in a group. Yeah, I think that's one of the most challenging things of how do we make this accessible. I think generally that's kind of the range that folks are in, also depending on cost of living and where they're offering the services and where they're renting the space out.
Are there any insurance companies that cover this work yet, or where people can get it?
They're starting to be. I know Entheia is one that's beginning coverage for, and especially seeing ketamine-assisted psychotherapy as an employee benefit, you know, mm-hmm. for folks that are feeling burnt out, or that's something that's also being offered in some companies and some insurance. And then, I know that a lot of insurance companies are now examining how this could be part of the plan, but currently they aren't necessarily covered.
Okay. And for an ideal client, are there certain clients that would be ideal to you, or also certain clients that you probably would have to turn away for people that are considering to explore this?
I think there's never like a hard no. There's more of like who has a certain expertise that I don't have. Like, especially when we have folks with like a lot of comorbidity or a long history of like also like medical and other psychiatric disorders. Those are, there's not a complete no for me, but I would have to check on my capacity so I can collaborate as much as I need to, or that I just have the knowledge and the scope, both like, I think clinically, but also culturally. You know, I have different people that come and I just want to make sure that I have enough lived experience or consulting other people and have the capacity to do that in order to provide the most culturally attuned and sound services. So those are the processes that I commit to. And so it's usually like, do I have access to that? And if I don't, who can I refer them to?
Got it. Now, outside of psychotherapy and your CAP cohort access groups and medicine journeys, Wilhelmina, do you also do public speaking engagements, classes, or retreats for people that maybe want to look for how to access you outside of a therapeutic setting?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always like information. There's like podcasts like this and other speaking engagements. You know, I think through Prati, we have trainings specifically for clinicians that are curious around coming in. I also, in that training, for those that are interested in like who steward end of life work and grief work, you don't necessarily have to be a clinician to go to one of those trainings on how to leverage the medicines for that type of supportive work. And retreats. We often do retreats in which we'll have a range of different offerings along with medicine. And then we also do groups, and we are currently running a facilitator training program, a queer psychedelic facilitator education program. And so this is meant to be an affinity space made by and for queer folks. And so that is one program that we are currently running right now.
Cool. We're going to ask you more about that when we get to our closing. But before we jump into our closing, being that we're a wellness podcast, we like to ask our guests what their own wellness routines and self-care practices consist of. So tell us more about what are your wellness routines and self-care practices outside of the multiple hats that you wear.
Movement. I think, you know, I love going to spin class. I love walking. I think just getting into nature, because we are nature. And so always reconnecting kind of with the essence of who I am. And that's a lot of it. I think just being with the water, being with the earth, and cooking and like playing and like, you know, finding joy and being lighthearted. And also having quiet time by myself. I talk to a lot of people every day, so
yeah,
being quiet is nice.
Yeah. Now, we also like to just hear how our practitioners practice wellness and self-care, because it's not just important for them to seek you for the services that you offer, but to also hear about other ways that they can practice self-care outside of what they traditionally might know. Mm-hmm. Now, as you begin to close, how can our community find you or learn about your retreats, your journeys, your ceremonies, your services? If they have additional questions, tell us more about how they can find you.
Yeah, I think the best way to quickly reach out is going to be through our Instagram, which is like integrate_evolve. And our website is integrate2evolve.com. So that would be the best ways to kind of see our new offerings, especially on our Instagram.
Okay. And you mentioned, Wilhelmina, that, or we mentioned earlier that you're based in Southern California. Where do you physically do your hold your ceremonies and your journeys for those that might want to figure out how to access you?
Yeah, so many of our group journeys are over in Encinitas, so that's in North County, San Diego.
Okay.
And our retreats take place in Temecula. And I'm excited that we will begin to offer services and start opening another clinic up in the Los Angeles area soon.
Now, any final words? Is there anything else that you would want our community throughout the diaspora to know when it comes to psychedelic assisted therapy?
I think life is already psychedelic. So that, you know, I hope that this is received as a way to just share a little bit of my journey in some of these medicines. And it may be for some, it may not be for others. And so I think it's just an important position and conversation to stay curious. And it's such just an honor to speak with community.
It's an honor to speak with you, Wilhelmina, and just thank you for talking with us and teaching us more about psychedelic assisted therapy. We look forward to witnessing your personal journey unfold and can't wait to see what more you have in store within this arena as it continues to develop and evolve. We'll do our best to continue to also help share your upcoming work and opportunities as we stay connected in partnership.
Great.
And to our community, for our next episode, we'll be talking with Dr. Rona Saidi about mental health and chronic pain. Stay tuned as this episode will air on Wellness Wednesday, September 11th. As we close, we'd like to acknowledge once again our guest speaker, Wilhelmina De Castro. I also want to do a quick shout out to Sunshine Zerda, who referred us to you. I love Sunshine. And everybody does who encounters her. Our graphic designer and beat maker for our opening and closing track, Richie, our advisors, Allison De La Cruz, Rianne De Los Reyes, and Safo Teologo, our community partners, SoCal Filipinos, This Filipino American Life, Rising Filipinas, Therapy Nye, and all of our community members for your shares and support. As always, we'll share more about our guests' offerings on our Instagram stories and highlights for permanent access with any of their upcoming events. Be sure to follow us at PhilippineX in Wellness on Instagram, Threads, Facebook, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, and on X at PhilippineX, the letter N, well, followed by the letters N and S. Don't forget to continue to hit like and subscribe on our PhilippineX in Wellness YouTube channel. Thank you always for believing in us. Be well, everyone. Continue to take care of yourselves and each other. Madamogid na nga salamat.
Maraming salamat. We'll be right back.